Osho, The Dhammapada, The Way of the Buddha, Volume 6, Discourse Number 5.
Bhagwan, live in joy, in love, even among those who hate. Live in joy, in health, even among the afflicted. Live in joy, in peace, even among the troubled. Live in joy without possessions, like the shining ones. The winner sows hatred because the loser suffers. Let go of winning and losing, and find joy. There is no fire like passion, no crime like hatred, no sorrow like separation, no sickness like hunger, and no joy like the joy of freedom. Health, contentment, and trust are your greatest possessions, and freedom your greatest joy. Look within. Be still. Free from fear and attachment, know the sweet joy of the way. How joyful to look upon the awakened and to keep company with the wise. How long the road to the man who travels with a fool. But whoever follows those who follow the way discovers his family and is filled with joy. Follow then the shining ones, the wise, the awakened, the loving, for they know how to work and forbear. Follow them as the moon follows the path of the stars.
It is a pleasant surprise to meditate on these sutras of today. They go against the idea that prevails all over the world about Gautama the Buddha. He is represented by the enemies and even by his friends and followers as the pessimist par excellence. He is not a pessimist at all. He is one of the most joyous persons ever. These sutras will give you immense insight into the heart of this awakened man. Live in joy, in love, even among those who hate. Joy is the key word of all these sutras. Joy is not happiness, because happiness is always mixed with unhappiness. It is never found in purity. It is always polluted. It has always a long shadow behind it of misery. Just as the day is followed by night, happiness is followed by unhappiness. Then what is joy? Joy is a state of transcendence. One is neither happy nor unhappy, but utterly peaceful, quiet, in absolute equilibrium. so silent and so alive that his silence is a song, that his song is nothing but his silence. Joy is forever. Happiness is momentary. Happiness is caused from the outside, hence can be taken away from the outside. You have to depend on others, and any dependence is ugly. Any dependence is a bondage. Joy arises within. It has nothing to do with the without. It is not caused by others. It is not caused at all. It is the spontaneous flow of your own energy. If your energy is stagnant, there is no joy. If your energy becomes a flow, a movement, a river, there is great joy. For no other reason, just because you become more fluid, more flowing, more alive, a song is born into your heart. A great ecstasy arises. It is a surprise when it arises, because you cannot find any cause for it. It is the most mysterious experience in life. Something uncaused, something beyond the law of cause and effect. It need not be caused, because it is your intrinsic nature. You are born with it. It is something inborn. It is you in your totality flowing. Whenever you are flowing towards the ocean. That is the joy, the dance of the river moving towards the ocean to meet the ultimate beloved. When your life is a stagnant pool, you are simply dying. You are not moving anywhere, no ocean, no hope. But when you are flowing, the ocean is coming closer every moment. And the closer comes the river, more dance, more ecstasy is there. Your consciousness is a river. Buddha has called it continuum. It is a continuity, eternal continuity, eternal flow. Buddha has never thought about you and your being as something static. In his vision, the word being is not right. According to him, being is nothing but becoming. He denies being. He accepts becoming. Because being gives you a static idea of something inside you, like a rock. Becoming gives you a totally different idea, like a river, like a lotus opening, like the sunrise. Something is constantly happening. You are not there sitting like a rock. You are growing. Buddha changes the whole metaphysics. He replaces being by becoming. He replaces things by processes. He replaces nouns by verbs. Live in joy. Live in your own innermost nature with absolute acceptance of whosoever you are. Don't try to manipulate yourself according to others' ideas. Just be yourself, your authentic nature, and joy is bound to arise. It wells up within you. When the tree is taken care of, watered, looked after, it naturally blooms one day when the spring comes. There is great flowering. So is man. Take care of yourself. Find the right soil for your being. Find the right climate. And go deeper and deeper into yourself. Don't explore the world. Explore your nature. Because by exploring the world, you may have many possessions, but you will not be a master. But by exploring yourself, you may not have many possessions, but you will be a master. It is better to be a master of your own self than to be a master of the whole world. Live in joy, in love. And one who lives in joy naturally lives in love. Love is the fragrance of the flower of joy. Inside there is joy. You cannot contain it. It is so much. It is unbearable. If you try to be miserly about it, you will feel pain. Joy can be too much, that if you don't share it, it can become suffering. It can become pain. Joy has to be shared. By sharing it, you are unburdened. By sharing it, new sources open up within you. New streams, new springs. That sharing of your joy is love. Hence, one thing has to be remembered. You cannot love unless you have attained to joy. And millions of people go on doing that. They want to love, and they don't know anything what joy is. Then their love is hollow, empty, meaningless. Then their love brings despair, misery, anguish. It creates hell. Unless you have joy, you can't be in love. You have nothing to give. You are a beggar yourself. First, you need to be a king. And your joy will make you a king. When you are radiating joy, Buddha says, when you have become the shining one, when your hidden secrets are no more secrets but are flowering in the wind, in the rain, in the sun, when your imprisoned splendor is released, when your mystery has become an open phenomenon. When it is vibrating around you, pulsating around you, when it is in your breath, in your heart beats, then you can love. Then you touch dust, and the dust is transformed into the divine. Then whatsoever you touch becomes gold. Ordinary pebbles in your hands will be transmuted into diamonds, emeralds. Ordinary people touched by you will not be any more ordinary. A man who has attained to joy becomes a source of great transformation for many people. His flame has been lit. Now he can help others. The unlit flames coming closer to the one who has become a fire with joy can become lit also. That's what satsang is, communion with a master is. Coming closer to his fire, coming closer to his splendor, coming closer to his glory, coming closer to what has happened to him. And just by coming closer, the flame jumps into you, and you are never the same again. Love is possible only when your flame is lit. Otherwise, you are a dark continent, and you are pretending to give light to others. Love is light. Hate is darkness. You are dark within and trying to give light to others. You will only succeed in giving them more darkness. And they are already in darkness. You will multiply their darkness. You will make them more miserable. Don't try to do that, because it is impossible. It is not according to the nature of things. It can't happen. You can hope, but all hope is in vain. First, be filled with joy. Live in joy, in love, even among those who hate. And then it is not a question what others do to you. Then one can love even those who hate him. Then one can live in love and joy even amongst enemies. A disciple of Buddha became enlightened. And Buddha said to him that now that you have entered the temple, you go and spread the message, because there are many who need a little help. There are many who are drowning in the river of sorrow. Now you have learned how to swim. Help others. Now you have the boat. You can take them to the other shore. Remember the way I helped you. Now you go and help others. The disciple said, whatsoever you say, I will do. I will go. It hurts to leave you. It hurts it is painful to go away from you. But if you say, then I will go. If you had told me before, see the love of a disciple, of a devotee. He says, if you had told me before, I would not have tried for enlightenment at all. Because to be with you is far more significant. I would have risked enlightenment. I would have dropped the very project if I had known it before that I will have to leave. But now it is too late. If you say, I will go. Buddha asked him, you can choose the direction, the place, where you would like to go. In Bihar there was one part where no disciple of Buddha has ever gone. Sukha was the name of the place. The disciple said, I will go to Sukha. Buddha looked a little surprised. The disciple was young, very young. Not only in age, but young also in his enlightenment. He does not know the ways of the world. Buddha said, you are not aware, it seems, that the people of Sukha are very dangerous people, murderers, thieves, robbers. That's why no one has yet chosen to go there. The young man said, but that's why I am choosing to go there, because they also need your message. They also need you. And more so than others. Bless me so that I can go and help few people there. Buddha said, then you will have to answer three questions. First is, those people are such mischievous. I know them. If you go there, they won't listen to you. They will insult you. They will try to humiliate you. They are going to be very nasty to you. When they will insult and will be nasty to you, how you are going to respond? The young man said, there is no need to ask me, you know how I am going to respond. I will thank them, will be grateful to them, because they are good people. They only insult me. They only humiliate me. They could have beaten me, and they are not beating me. They could have thrown stones at me, and they are not throwing stones at me. They are good people. I will be grateful to them that they are not harming my body. Buddha said, and if they start hitting you, beating you, wounding you, throwing stones at you, then what will be your response? And the young man said, still I will be tremendously grateful to them that they are only throwing stones at me, beating me, but are still leaving me alive, are not killing me. They could have killed. Buddha said, now the last question. If they kill you, by the time you are dying, in those last moments, when you are dying, what will be your response? The young man said, I will be grateful to them still, because they have only killed my body. They cannot kill me. And the body was going to go anyway, sooner or later. And I will be also grateful that they have destroyed the body, and now they have taken all opportunities of committing any error from me. I will not be able to commit any errors. I will not be able to go astray. I will be thankful. I will die with great gratitude. Buddha said, now you can go anywhere. You can go to Sukha or wherever you choose. You are ready. If this is your response, you have become a Buddha. You are the shining one. It is not a question to love those who love you. That is very ordinary. That is business-like, a bargain. The real love is to love those who hate you. Right now, even to love those who love you is not possible. Because you don't know what joy is. But when you know the joy, the miracle happens, the magic. You are capable then to love those who hate you. In fact, it is no more a question of loving somebody or not loving somebody. Because you become love. You don't have anything else left. In Quran, I have heard, there comes a statement that hate the devil. A great Sufi mystic woman, Rabia, cancelled that line from her Quran. Hassan, another famous mystic, was staying with Rabia. He saw Rabia doing it. He said, what are you doing? The Quran cannot be corrected. That is blasphemy. You cannot cut any statement from the Quran. It is perfect as it is. There is no possibility of any improvement. What are you doing? Rabia said, Hassan, I have to do it. It is not a question of Quran. It is something totally different. Since I have known God, I cannot hate. It is not a question of devil. I simply cannot hate. Even if devil comes in front of me, I will love him. Because now I can only love. I am incapable of hate. That has disappeared. If one is full of light, he can only give you light. Whether you are a friend or an enemy does not matter. From where Rabia says, I can bring darkness to throw on the devil. It is no more anywhere. I am light. My light will fall on the devil as much as on God. Now for me there is no God and no devil. I cannot even make a distinction. My whole being is transformed into love. Nothing is left. I am not correcting Quran. Who am I to correct it? But this statement is no more relevant to me, and this is my copy. I am not correcting anybody else's Quran. I have the right to put my copyright according to myself. This statement hits me hard whenever I come across it. I cannot make any sense out of it. Hence I am crossing it out. a man who is full of joy and love can't help. He loves the friends, the enemies. It is not a question of decision on his part. Love is now his nature, like breathing. Will you stop breathing if an enemy comes to see you? Will you say, how I can breathe in front of the enemy? Will you say that, how can I breathe? Because the enemy is also breathing. And his air, which has passed through his lungs, may enter into me. I can't breathe. You will get suffocated. You will die. It will be a suicide and utterly stupid. A moment comes on the way when love is just like breathing. The breathing of your soul. You go on loving. In this light you can understand Jesus' statement, love your enemies as yourself. If you ask Buddha, he will say, there is no need to say such a thing because you can't do otherwise. You have to love. In fact, you are love. So wherever you are, in flowers, in thorns, in the dark night, in the full noontide, in misery surrounding you like an ocean, or in great success, it does not matter. You remain love. Everything else becomes immaterial. Your love becomes something of the eternal. It continues. One may accept it, one may not accept it. But you can't help. You have to be your true nature. Live in joy, repeats Buddha, in health, even among the afflicted. By health, Buddha means wholeness. Health comes from the same root as healing. A healed person is a healthy person. A healed person is the whole person. Buddha does not mean by health the ordinary medical meaning of the term. His meaning is not medicinal. It is meditational. Although you will be surprised to know that the word meditation and medicine both come from the same root. Medicine heals you physically. Meditation heals you spiritually. Both are healing processes. Both bring health. But Buddha is not talking about the health of the body. He is talking about the health of your soul. Be whole. Be total. Don't be fragmentary. Don't be divided. Be an individual. Literally, indivisible. One piece. People are not one piece. There are many fragments, somehow holding them together. They can fall apart any moment. They are all Humpty Dumpties. Just bundles of many things. Any new situation, any new danger, any insecurity, and they can fall apart. Your wife dies, or you go bankrupt, or you are unemployed. Any small thing can prove the last straw on the camel. The difference is only of degrees. Somebody is boiling at 98 degrees, somebody at 99, somebody may be 99.9 degrees. But the difference is only of degrees. And any small thing can change the balance. You can go insane any moment. You can become many in any moment, because already inside you are a crowd. So many desires, so many dreams. So many people are living in you. If you watch carefully, you will not find one person there, but many faces, changing every moment. It is as if you are just a marketplace where so many people are going and coming, and much noise, and nothing makes sense. Just the other day, Subhas has asked a question, Bhagwan, do you ever dream? You can dream only if you are many. You can dream only if you have many desires. I have none. Dream is a byproduct of desiring. What you desire in the day, in the night you dream. Dream is a hangover. Something has remained incomplete in the day, and that has to be completed. The mind is a perfectionist. It wants to try in every possible way to complete things. You passed on the road, you saw a beautiful restaurant, but you were in a hurry, you were going for some work, and you could not enter into the restaurant. And the smell of the food was so enchanting, and the color of the food, and you wanted to go in, but you could not. You will dream about the restaurant. You will have to dream just to complete the whole process, so that it drops and no more goes on hanging on you. But your dreams will reflect your insanity. A sane person cannot dream. But by a sane person I mean the shining one, the Buddha. I don't mean by the sane what you mean by the words. To you, the insane people are in the insane asylums, and everybody outside is sane. It is not so. Just the wall of the asylum does not divide the sin from the insane. There are insane people inside and there are insane people outside. The people who are outside are still not caught, or maybe are still within the boundary of normal behavior. At least on the surface they can manage. In their innermost core they may be insane. I cannot dream even if I want to. It is impossible. Whenever I am sitting, I am simply sitting. There is no thought. And when I am sleeping, I am simply sleeping. There is no dream. But Suhas must be suffering from dreams. Everybody is suffering, day in, day out. I am worried. Last night I dreamt I was alone with 100 beautiful blondes, 100 beautiful brunettes, and 100 beautiful redheads. It was horrible. Good heavens, man, what is so horrible about that? Ask the psychiatrist to the patient. I dreamt that I was a girl too. Your dreams will reflect to you. Who else they can reflect? Your dreams are keys. Through your dreams much can be known about you. The whole psychoanalysis depends on your dreams for clues. When you are awake, you are not trustworthy. What you say about yourself is deceptive. In your dreams you are more innocent, because there is nobody to control and repress. The conscience is fast asleep, the morality gone. You are more natural, more normal. In your dreams, you are truer. Hence, psychoanalysis has to depend on your dreams. And through your dreams, it comes to conclusions about you. This is a very sad state of affairs, that you cannot be trusted at all. Because you say one thing, and you are totally something else. And it is not that you deliberately try to deceive. Deception has become almost your second nature. That's why you immediately forget your dreams. That is a strategy of the mind. Within 5 seconds, when you wake up, a little lingering is there, a little memory. Just few fragments, the last parts of your dreams are there. But within 5 seconds they are gone. By the time you are out of the bed, all dreams have disappeared, you have forgotten all about them. Unless you make a very conscious effort, you will not be able to remember them. This is a strategy of the mind. It simply closes the door. Because your dreams can be a disturbance to you. If you come to know that in your dream you killed your father, it will be heavy on you. You may feel guilty. If you are a very, very moralistic, Puritan person and you see that in your dream you had eloped, escaped with the wife of your neighbor, and you were enjoying it, you will be disturbed. you will become suspicious about your morality, about your purity. It will hang over you like a dark cloud. The mind simply cuts you off from your dreams. It has created two kinds of worlds. One, the dreaming world, totally separate, and one, the so-called waking world, totally separate. You live in compartments. When you enter into dreaming, you forget all about waking. When you enter into waking, you forget all about dreaming. The Buddha is awake even while he is asleep. He has no compartments of his being. He is not many. He is one. Because he is one and he has no clinging to the memories and no desires for the future, for him the present is enough. Then he lives moment to moment in its totality. He does not go on living partially. Your dreams so simply that you live partially. And the unlived parts have to be lived in your dreams. If you live totally each moment, then there is no possibility of any dream. Once it happened, a Sufi came to me, a very beautiful person, and doing Sufi meditation, zikr, he had become capable of reading other people's thoughts. Some of his disciples, who were known to me also, wanted him to come and read my thoughts. I said, okay, bring him. The man was really capable. He will simply close his eyes and he will start saying what thoughts are passing within you. For half an hour, he remained with closed eyes, very puzzled. Then finally he gave up. He said, but I don't see anything. Just utter emptiness. He said, this is for the first time that I can't read. What have you done to me? I have not done anything to him, I said to him. I have not done anything. I am simply sitting here, not doing anything to you or to anybody else. But because there are no thoughts, how can you read? Not that I have stopped your capacity to read. He was thinking that I have done some damage to his thought reading. I said, I have not done anything. If you want, then I can start bringing few thoughts. It will be an effort, just the way I speak. I will start speaking inside. I will have to think of my sannyasins. And I will have to speak to them. Then you can read. Your capacity is intact. But I was just sitting silently, the way I always sit when I am alone. Neither in the daytime I am thinking, nor in the night I am dreaming. All dreams have disappeared the day desires disappear. All thoughts have become meaningless the day I came to know that I am not the mind. But I understand your difficulties. I understand your confusion. A wealthy tycoon went for a cruise on his fancy yacht, taking with him 5 buddies, 6 gorgeous girls, and a sailor to mend the ship. They encountered a severe storm, and the boat went down with the tycoon and his buddies, but the women and the sailor managed to make it to a desert island, along with a waterproof bag of limited provisions. All went well for almost a week. Our sailor friend and his Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday and Saturday well taken care of. The only problem was that they were running out of food. On Sunday, a voluptuous native woman approached, bearing gifts of bananas, coconuts and other edibles. The gorgeous girls were overjoyed. "We are saved," they cried. But the sailor muttered resignedly to himself, "There go my Sundays." You are living inside in a very confused state. And not only the young people, but even when they become old, the same state continues. Not only continues, it becomes more and more confusing. Because as you accumulate experience, your confusion becomes greater. Interviewing the 65-year-old rodeo champion in Amarillo, Texas, the New York newspaperman remarked, "You are really an extraordinary man to be a rodeo champion at your age." "Heck," said the cowboy, "I am not nearly the man my pa is. He was just signed to play guard for a pro football team, and he is 88. "Amazing," guessed the journalist. "I would like to meet your father." "Can't right now. He is in Fort Worth, standing up for Grandpa. Grandpa is getting married tomorrow. He is 114. "Your family is simply unbelievable," said the newspaperman. "Here you are, a rodeo champion at 65. Your father is a football player at 88. And now your grandfather wants to get married at 114? "Hell, mister, you got that wrong," said the Texan. "Grandpa does not want to get married. He has to." You go on accumulating. Your childhood is the closest to Buddhahood. As you grow old, you grow insane. As you grow old, you go farther and farther away from Buddhahood. It is really a very strange state. It should not be so. One should grow towards Buddhahood, but people grow just in the opposite direction. Buddha says, "Live in joy, in health, even among the afflicted." This is a very important sutra to be remembered. More so because the Christian missionaries are creating a totally wrong approach to life. They say, when there is so much misery in the world, how can you be joyous? Sometimes they come to me And they say people are starving and people are poor. How can you teach people to dance and sing and be joyous? There are so many people afflicted with so many diseases. And you teach people meditation? This is selfishness. But that's exactly what Buddha is saying. He is saying live in joy, in health, even among the afflicted. Live in joy, in peace, even among the troubled. You cannot change the whole world. You have a small life span. It will be gone soon. You cannot change the whole world. You cannot make it a condition that I will rejoice only when the whole world has changed and everybody is happy. That is never going to happen. And it is not within your capacity to do it either. People have decided to be miserable. That is their decision. Otherwise, nobody is forcing them to be miserable. Poverty is their decision, maybe taken unconsciously, but poverty is their decision. You can see it happening. Just 300 years before, the native people of America were as poor as one can imagine. They had the land, the same land, but they had chosen a lifestyle which kept them poor. Now America has become the richest country. It is the same country, but with a different type of people. And you will be surprised that the first people who arrived in America were not very virtuous, religious type of people. No. In fact, the virtuous and the religious remain miserable. The people who reached America and Australia, the pioneers, were more down to earth. People who believe in eat, drink and be merry. These were the people who transformed the whole fate of American continent. They transformed a poor country into the richest ever. Now the same can happen to this country. But it has taken a wrong style of life. And it has lived with its style of life for so many centuries that it seems that is the only way to live. And it worships people who support its style because they fit with its ideology. This country cannot agree with me because I am trying to change the very style of life, the very pattern, the very structure of their thought, their mind, their being. They can become as rich as any country in the world, maybe the richest. But first they will have to change their whole style of thinking, living, being. They worship poverty, then how they can become rich? They condemn richness. How they can become rich? They condemn all joys of the earth. They are all for renunciation. They are anti-life. How can life shower upon them its graces, its bliss, its joys? They are not receptive. They are completely blind and deaf. If you want that everybody should be happy, only then you can be happy, then you are never going to be happy. Buddha is stating a simple fact. He is saying, live in joy, in health, even among the afflicted. He is not saying that don't help them. But by being ill yourself, you cannot help them. By being poor yourself, you cannot help the poor. Although the poor will worship you, because they will see how great a saint you are. They worshipped Mahatma Gandhi for the sheer reason that he tried to live like a poor man. But just by living like a poor man, you are not going to help the poor. If the doctor also falls ill to help his patients, will you call him a saint? You will call him just stupid. Because this is the time he needs all health so that he can be helpful to people. This is a strange logic, but it has prevailed down the centuries. That if you want to help the poor, be poor. Live a poor life. Live just like the poor. Of course, the poor people will give you great respect and honor. But that is not going to help the poor. It will only fulfill your ego. And any ego fulfilled creates misery for you, not joy. Live in joy in health, even among the afflicted. Live in joy in peace, even among the troubled. That is the only way to help, the only way to serve. First be selfish. First transform yourself, your life in peace, in joy, in health, can be a great source of nourishment for people who are starving for spiritual food. People are not really starving for material things. Material richness is very simple. Just a little more technology, a little more science, and people can be rich. The real problem is how to be rich inwardly. And when you are rich outwardly, you will be surprised that for the first time you become aware of your inner poverty more acutely, more keenly. For the first time all meaning in life disappears when you are rich outwardly, because in contrast, the inner poverty can be seen more clearly. Outside is light all around, and inside you are a dark island. The rich man knows his poverty more than the poor person, because the poor person has no contrast. Outside is darkness, inside is darkness. He knows darkness is what life is. But when outside is light, you become desirous of a new phenomenon. You long for inner light. When you see that richness is possible outside, why not you can be rich inside? Live in joy without possessions, like the shining ones. Buddha says, enjoy the world, enjoy the sun, the moon, the stars, the flowers, the sky, the earth. Live in joy and peace without possessiveness. Don't possess, use, but don't possess, because the possessor cannot use. The possessor really becomes possessed by his own possessions. That's why so many rich people you find become very miserly. They live a poor life. They have all the money in the world, but they live in a poor way. The richest man in the world just 50 years before was the Nizam of Hyderabad. The richest man in the world. In fact, his riches were so that nobody has been ever able to estimate how much he had. His treasures were full of diamonds. Everything was made of diamonds, even his paperweights. Was the biggest diamond in the world. Even the Kohinoor is only 1/3 size of his paperweight. When he died, his paperweight was found in his shoe. The diamonds were not counted because they were so many. They were weighed, not counted. How many kilos, not how many diamonds. Who will count? Each year, the diamonds were brought out of the basements. He has the biggest palace in India. But all the roofs were not enough, because his diamonds were spread on the roofs of his palace just to give them a little sunlight every year. But the man lived a life of such misery you cannot believe. Even beggars live far better. He used to collect cigarettes which others have already smoked and thrown. Just cigarette ends. He will not purchase cigarettes for himself. He will collect these cigarettes and will smoke them. Such a miser. For 50 years he used only one single cap. It was so dirty and stinking. He died in the same cap. He never used to change his clothes. And it is said that he used to purchase his clothes from the second hand marketplace where old rotten things, used things are sold. His shoes must have been the dirtiest in the world. But he will only send them once in a while for repair. He will not purchase new shoes. Now the richest man in the world, and living in such misery and miserliness, what has happened to this man? Possessiveness. Possessiveness is his disease, his mania. He wanted to possess everything. He will purchase diamonds all over the world, wherever there were diamonds. His agent was there to purchase. Just have more and more. You cannot eat diamonds. But he was eating the poorest kind of food. And he was so much afraid that he was unable to sleep at all. Constant fear somebody may steal. That's how the paperweight, the costliest diamond that he had, 3 times more in weight than the Kohinoor, was found in his shoe. When he was dying, he has hidden it in his shoe. So nobody can steal it, otherwise just the paperweight will be so much in the eyes of people. Even dying, he was more concerned with the diamond than his own life. He could never give to anybody anything. This happens to people who become possessive. They don't use things, they are used by things. They are not masters, they are servants of their own things. They go on accumulating and they die without ever having enjoyed all that they had. Buddha says, live in joy. Without possessions, like the shining ones, live like the Buddhas, who don't possess a thing, but they can use everything. The world has to be used, not to be possessed. We come empty-handed and we go empty-handed. So there is no point in possessing anything. To be possessive is ugly. But use, while you are, use the world, enjoy everything that the world makes available, and then go without looking back, without clinging to things. This is the way of the Buddhas. Es Dhammo Sanantano. This is the inexhaustible law of the Buddhas. Then a Buddha can be a beggar, if he chooses it to be so. That is his way. Or a Buddha can be an emperor. There have been emperors who were Buddhas. In India there has been one man, Janaka, the father of Sita, Rama's wife, who was a Buddha. He lived in the palace with all the richness of a great king. And yet, he was absolutely non-possessive. He possessed nothing. He was just as if you are staying in a hotel. You don't possess anything. You stay for a few hours, few days, and then you are gone. You use. The intelligent person uses life and uses beautifully, aesthetically, sensitively. Then the world has many treasures for him. He never becomes attached. Because the moment you become attached, you have fallen asleep. The winner sows hatred because the loser suffers. Let go of winning and losing and find joy. How to find joy? Let your ambition disappear. Ambition is the barrier. Ambition means an ego trip. I want to be this, I want to be that. More money, more power, more prestige. But remember, Buddha says the winner sows hatred. Because the loser suffers. Let go of winning and losing and find joy. If you want to find joy, forget about winning and losing. Life is a play, a game. Play it beautifully. Forget all about losing and winning. The real sportsman's spirit is not that of winning or losing. It is not his real question. He enjoys play. That is the real player. If you are playing to win, you will play with tension, anxiety. You are not concerned with the play itself and its joy and its mystery. You are more concerned with the outcome. This is not the right way to live in the world. Live in the world without any idea what is going to happen, whether I am going to be a winner or a loser. It doesn't matter. Death takes everything away. Whether you lose or win is immaterial. The only thing that matters is and has always been that how you played the game. Did you enjoy it? The game itself. Then each moment is of joy. You never sacrifice the moment for the future. There is no fire-like passion. Buddha says, beware of lust. Love is beautiful, but lust is just fire. It burns you and burns you badly. It wounds you. A marine regiment was sent back for rest after a rough tour of duty at the front. At the base, they discovered a contingent of vets violated and awaiting assignment to various posts. The marine colonel addressed himself to the WAC commander, warning her that his men had been in the front lines a long time and might not be too careful about their attitudes toward the WACs. "Keep them locked up," he told the WAC commander, "if you don't want any trouble." "Trouble?" said C. "There will be no trouble. My girls have it up here." She tapped her forehead significantly. "Madam," barked the marine, "it makes no difference where they have it. My boys will find it. Keep them locked up." Lust is a madness. Lust is fire. Lust is poison. It keeps people blind from seeing the truth. It keeps them foolish. It keeps them unaware. It keeps them drunk. It was sundown, and the young athlete was doing push-ups on the beach when a drunk appeared. The drunk weaved his way to within a few yards of the perspiring young man, sat down on the sand, and laughed and laughed. "What in the devil are you laughing about?" asked the unhired young man. The drunk laughed and laughed and then sputtered, "Don't look now, but somebody stole your girl." A man who lives through lust lives absolutely unconsciously. Whatsoever he is going to do is going to be wrong. Whatsoever he is going to say and see is going to be wrong. He can't see. He is blind. He can't hear. He is deaf. Nothing makes people more ugly and animal-like than lust. Hence Buddha says, there is no fire-like passion, no crime-like hatred. Why no crime-like hatred? Because everything else, other crimes arise out of it. It is the very source. And there is no virtue like friendliness, love, because all other virtues arise out of it. Love is the greatest virtue, and hatred the greatest sin. No sorrow-like separation. Buddha said, the only thing that is making you so sad is the separation from existence. In your unconsciousness, you have believed that you are separate. You have started living a life of the ego. You are not following the ultimate law, the Dhamma. You are not flowing with the river. You are resisting, fighting. Do not resist. Do not fight. Flow with the river. Go with the Dhamma, the law. Be in harmony with the whole. Don't think yourself separate. You are not. No man is an island. We are all parts of a vast continent of consciousness. No sorrow-like separation. And a very significant statement, no sickness-like hunger. Now, how Buddha can support poverty? He cannot. If hunger is the worst sickness in the world, then poverty is the cause of it. All kinds of crimes, immoralities, sins, vices arise out of poverty. I have no respect for poverty. I have absolute condemnation for it. It is the ugliest wound on human soul. It has to disappear. We have to make the earth rich. And now it can be done. It was not possible in the past. Now it is possible. If it is not happening, it is only because of our old stupid ideas. Now in India, which is one of the poorest of the countries, those stupid ideas are so dominant that people still believe that by spinning your own clothes you are doing something spiritual. The spinning wheel has become a symbol of saintliness. All the Indian politicians once in a while pose for photographs with their spinning wheels. Once a year they go to Mahatma Gandhi's Samadhi and then they sit there for 1 hour or so spinning wheels so that photographs can be taken. Why this spinning wheel and why the so much praise for clothes made by our own hands? If you try to wear only clothes made by our own hands, then the whole world is going to remain poor. The machines can do, and in a far better way. The machines can become a great liberation to man. They have to be used rightly. If you don't use them rightly, they can be dangerous. They can pollute the whole nature. They can destroy the whole balance. The ecology can be disturbed by them. But if you use them consciously, meditatively, then all slavery can disappear from the world, because the machine can do the work that man has been doing for ages. It can provide food, clothes, shelter. Hence I am all for science. I am not against science. And I am all for religion too, because I can see a possibility of great synthesis arising in the future. It has to arise now. If it does not arise, then man is doomed and finished, and man has no future, no hope. The world can be made rich outwardly with technology and science, and the inner world can be made rich by meditation, by prayer, by love, by joy. And when we can create a new human being, fulfilled within and without both. No sickness like hunger, and no joy like the joy of freedom. Buddha says, the greatest joy in life is freedom. Freedom from all prejudices. Freedom from all scriptures. Freedom from all concepts, ideologies. Freedom from all desires. Freedom from all possessiveness, jealousy. Freedom from all hatred, anger, rage, lust. Inside, freedom from everything, so that you are just a pure consciousness, unbounded, unlimited. That is the greatest joy. And it is possible. And it is within everybody's grasp. Thus, just you have to grope for it a little. The groping will be in the dark, but it is not far away. If you try, if you make an effort, you are bound to find it. It is our birthright. Health, contentment and trust are your greatest possessions, and freedom your greatest joy. Be whole, that is health. Be contented, that is desirelessness. And trust, that is drop your separation, your fight with nature. These three things to be remembered. Be whole, be one, be contented, desireless. Whatsoever is beautiful. Enjoy it to its totality. Squeeze the whole juice out of it. Each moment, drink the reality as totally as possible. So you need not look back. You need not ever think that you missed that moment. And never plan for the future, because when the future will come, it will come. You only go on living each moment as totally as possible. So when the future becomes present, you can live that too totally. Don't plan for it, because it is unpredictable. All your planning is going to be irrelevant. And once you have planned for something and it doesn't happen, then you are frustrated. And it never happens. There is a proverb, man proposes and God disposes. Yes, that's how it is felt. But the reality is not that God is there sitting and disposing whatsoever you propose. The fault is not of God, the fault is yours, because you propose. And out of your unawareness, what can you propose? Out of your mind, whatsoever you project is going to be something different than the whole. It is still a fight with the whole. Hence, trust. No need to fight. We are part of the whole. We arise out of the ocean of the whole as a wave, and we disappear back into the ocean. Enjoy the sunlight and the wind for the moment, and then disappear. Appear beautifully, joyously dancing, and disappear beautifully, joyously dancing. Live with immense joy and die with immense joy. This is how a sannyasin has to be. He knows the art of living and he knows the art and ecstasy of dying. Look within. Be still. Free from fear and attachment. Know the sweet joy of the way. Look within. Simple are the sutras. Intellectually very simple, but existentially arduous. Because we have become so accustomed to look out. We have forgotten completely that there is something like within too. Look within. Be still. And the way to look within is be still. Learn to sit silently for few hours at least. Doing nothing. Just be. Breathing. Watching your thoughts. That too not with a strain. In a very relaxed way. As if you are not much concerned what is passing by. An indifferent watchfulness. Aloof, unconcerned, cool. Go on seeing the traffic of the mind. Slowly, slowly, as your coolness deepens, as your indifference becomes bigger, more crystallized, the thoughts will be coming less and less. And one day you are simply sitting there with no thought at all. You look around, no thoughts. The mind is empty. In that moment of inner emptiness, all fear disappears, all attachment disappears, and one comes to know the sweet joy of the way. How joyful to look upon the awakened. Even to look upon the awakened is joyful. What to say about when you will become awakened? How sweet it will be. How joyful to be a Buddha yourself. Just to see a Buddha is such a joy. It brings such hope. It triggers in you a new process. It makes you aware what you are supposed to be, what nature in the first place wanted you to be. Buddha becomes your future, your possibility, your potential. He provokes your potential. He calls you forth out of your grave. How joyful to look upon the awakened. And to keep company with the wise. And if you are fortunate enough to keep company with the wise, with the awakened, with the shining ones, then nothing better than that can ever happen to you. Because it is only in the company of the Buddhas, the awakened ones, the wise, that there is a possibility of your change, of your transformation. How long the road to the man who travels with a fool? And we are not traveling with one fool or two fools, we are traveling with the whole load of fools. The whole crowd of fools surrounds you. By the fools, Buddha means those who are not yet awakened. Even if they want to do something good, they are bound to do something evil. They can't do good. A fool is a fool. He lives in unconsciousness. But you trust the fools. You trust them more than you trust the Buddhas. For the simple reason, because the fool speaks your language. Because the fool seems just like you. A new superintendent came to the mad asylum, and the old was retiring. So they had a ceremony to say goodbye to the old and welcome the new. They really rejoiced, they danced. The old superintendent was a little bit surprised. He had never seen them in his whole life's time. He has been there, so joyous. He asked them, "Why you are so joyous?" Those mad people said, "It is simple. You are not one of us, but this man looks just one of us. The new superintendent looks to be more crazy than we are. That's why we are rejoicing. You really never belonged to us. You were an outsider. But this man is an insider. Just for 2-3 days he has been here. He is a friend. We can understand him, he can understand us." The mad people are happy with another mad person. The fools are happy with other fools. And when you are with the fools, you feel very good, because he is not superior to you. Your ego is not hurt. But when you live with a Buddha, sometimes you feel very much disturbed, because he is so superior to you, that if you start feeling hurt, you will have to escape him, or you will have to kill him. I receive letters and telegrams from all over the world. Just the other day, Lakshmi brought a telegram from Milan, Italy. This is the third from the same man, who goes on sending a message that I want to kill you. Now Milan is so far away. Why he is so much worried about me? And he means business. 3 times in a month he has telegrammed. I hope that he comes sometimes. So many letters come that we would like to kill you. Why people are offended? And offended by a man who never leaves his room. Now why I am disturbing people in Milan and Berlin and New York and Delhi and Calcutta? Why? For the simple reason, they feel hurt. Now it depends on your interpretation. You can rejoice in the presence of a Buddha, then you start growing. You can feel hurt in the presence of a Buddha, then you start feeling offended, humiliated. You become angry. And it has happened many times. Jesus is crucified, Socrates is poisoned, Mansur is butchered. The same men, the same people have been doing the same thing again and again. One is fortunate if one can feel joyful just by looking the way a Buddha is. And more fortunate, of course, are those who can keep company with him. Your mind will suggest you many ways to escape. Your mind is cunning, very devious. It will find out such beautiful reasons that you cannot conceive. Unless you are very alert, you are bound to be deceived by your own mind. To keep company with your mind is to keep company with a fool. How long the road to the man who travels with a fool? And you are traveling with fools on the outside, and you are traveling with the fool, the real fool inside, your own mind. But whoever follows those who follow the way discovers his family and is filled with joy. That's why I say, to be a sannyasin is to come back home, to find your family. But whoever follows those who follow the way discovers his family. Your real family is not your father, your mother, your brothers, your sisters, your wife, your husband, your children. They are just accidental. Your real family is the family of a Buddha. If you are fortunate to feel joyful in the company of a Buddha, then dissolve into that company. You have found your family. Don't miss the chance, because the chance is very rare. Only once in a while somebody becomes enlightened. Follow then the shining ones, the wise, the awakened, the loving, for they know how to work and forbear. Be with the Buddhas, the shining ones, the wise, the awakened, the loving, because they know how to work on you, and they know how to be patient with you. They know how to transform you. They have been to the highest peak. They come back to the dark valley just to call you forth, to take you with themselves to the highest peak of life, freedom. Follow them as the moon follows the path of the stars. Be courageous. Be adventurous. Risk all, because less than that won't do. Risk all and trust. And if you want to be a Buddha, then the only way is become more meditative, so that you can start understanding his ways, his methods. Become more loving, so you can understand his love. Because his love is totally different than you have known. His love is cool. It is not hot passion. It is a very, very cool breeze. Those who don't understand, for them it will look cold. Those who understand, they will rejoice in its coolness. They will be rejuvenated by its coolness. They will be refreshed. They will be reborn. Enough for today.